From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Gretchen Whitmer is laying plans for 2020.
We did some good things together last year. It was a contentious year, but I feel like we're set up to be more productive, more worthy of the people of Michigan.
We catch up on the state of the state today. Also on the show, an investigative report on how one predator's crimes went unpunished.
I really felt honored that he would want to spend time with us. This amazing guy with all of this stuff going on has taken an interest in us.
And we remember a former Detroit resident whose story offers a parable of unchecked executive privilege.
The court took the position that when the government invokes national security, the safety of the nation, the court is not going to second guess the military and the president.
A look back at the life of Fred Korematsu. That's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, investigative reporting from Michigan Radio's newsroom about a member of a celibate Christian sect who violated sacred trust in his community.
They were almost always playing some kind of a game that involved a lot of physical contact.
We'll hear that reporting from Lindsay Smith in just a bit. Also on the show, we'll be speaking with State House Speaker Lee Chatfield and get his reaction to Governor Whitmer's new plan to pay for road repairs. But first, let's hear from Governor Whitmer herself. 42 minutes. That's all the time it took Gretchen Whitmer to push back at Republicans on road funding, task the legislature to get real about workplace harassment, and lay out new agenda items for her second year in office. If you missed the speech live on Michigan Radio last night, we're posting a link on today's show page at michiganradio.org. Governor Whitmer, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Some did cast this speech as an opportunity for a reset after a contentious end of the year. What did the temperature of the room feel like to you as you were making the speech, all those Republican legislators?
You know, it felt good. I think that, like any state of the state, there are the partisan differences and the applause lines and that kind of a thing. But I really went out of my way to acknowledge some of the good bipartisan work that we've done, whether it's in criminal justice reform or it is in auto insurance. We did some good things together last year. It was a contentious year, but I feel like we're set up to hopefully be more productive, more worthy of the people of Michigan.
In terms of topics that you put forth as priorities, roads have not exactly been a subject that unites. Many other points in the speech focused on things that have traditionally been Democratic Party priorities. What else do you see the GOP wanting to work on with you right now?
Well, the interesting thing is roads unites in a funny way because the vast majority of the public, no matter what side of the aisle they might find themselves on politically, wants us to fix the roads. I ran on it. Won overwhelmingly on it, and that's why I've got to move forward on it unilaterally if the legislature is not going to work with me on it. But I think that there's some opportunity around closing the skills gap. I identified the Michigan Reconnect, which is a plan to upskill adults who want to get into better paying jobs. We've got 100,000 high-end jobs that are going unfilled. They pay well, but they do require enhanced skills, and this is one way to meet that need and to give people, you know, a way to make more money and to be able to take care of themselves and their families.
You told us about the $3.5 billion bonding plan you have in mind for roads. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey told us that bonding is a finance tool, not a funding source. What's the long-term plan?
Well, I hope you asked him that question because I put a long-term plan on the table last year, and not only was it not embraced, but it wasn't countered with anything that was a serious attempt to fix the problem. And so I've invited them to share a plan with us and to get moving forward on it. I acknowledge in my speech this is not a long-term solution, but this is how we manage an asset that is deteriorating. This is how we keep people safe and ensure we've got infrastructure that will support these, the new innovative ways that we're building cars in Michigan. But ultimately, I can't fix the whole problem on my own. I can get started, but the legislature needs to, you know, this ball is in their court and they've got to come to the table with something real.
Last night, we heard you make a strong statement against workplace harassment and did so, by the way, with State Senator Pete Lucido there in the room. He's under investigation for three separate incidents right now. If these things are still happening in Lansing, is there a way for us to make any progress statewide?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I am an eternal optimist. I'm the mother of two daughters, and I'm someone who's worked in predominantly male professions my whole life, and I recognize this is a cultural change that needs to happen in our state and in our country. I think that it's important that when something like this happens, that a woman is supported and can come forward, and I'm glad that the Senate seems to be taking it seriously. I didn't name anyone by name. I just simply talked about the culture of vitriol and violence that is online and the harassment that can be in the workplace. And I called on every leader with a platform to take it on, call it out, and ensure that we're making our workplaces and our online spaces places where we can have robust debate, but it doesn't have to get harassing, and it certainly doesn't have to get hostile and violent.
We heard a lot in the final stretch of your speech about things that would resonate with women in Michigan. Paycheck issues, for sure, but also workplace harassment, preschool expansion, maternal mortality. Would you say these things were a call to action, or are there specific items, policy items, that you can do to move the needle on big social issues?
I would say both. You know, I think that we've seen more women get elected, more women, ascending to leadership positions. I think that that's a good, positive thing. There certainly is not, equal representation yet. That means that a lot of issues that we care about aren't, being prioritized. And that's why I thought it was important to acknowledge half of our workforce is female. And when it's also expected that we're the primary caregivers for our children, daycare makes a huge difference to our economy. When we prioritize ensuring that a new mom can have health care, not just for 60 days, a low-income mom, but for a full year, that's how we ensure she's got the support she needs to physically come back, but also to emotionally and mentally get the kind of wraparound support she needs. And we want women to be able to pick birth control that works for them so they can make the economic decisions of a head of a household and as an autonomous human being. So these are critical components, not just of an agenda that directly impacts moms and children. It is critical for our economy as well.
We heard a lot of positive themes about Michigan last night, a positive vision of Michigan. Next week, you're set to deliver the Democratic rebuttal to the president's State of the Union address. Will that positive vision of what's happening in Michigan make it into that speech?
Absolutely. I think, the Speaker Pelosi asked me to give the speech, and I think it's because she and the whole world recognizes the road to the White House goes through Michigan, that we decide elections, and what matters here should matter to the rest of the country. It's I don't think anyone from our state is going to be surprised about the things that I talk about or how I address them. And I'm hopeful that people in other states can see a vision for the future of our country as I talk about some of the great things that we're doing in Michigan.
Governor Whitmer, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Governor Whitmer's fellow Democrats haven't always seen eye to eye with her. The legislative majority is close enough that both parties will need to be involved in some of the issues Whitmer wants to work on. With us now is State Representative Christine Gregg, Democrat of House District 37. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to ask about the issue that seems to be at the top of everybody's to-do list. You've certainly had your differences with the governor over road funding. At the height of the debate last year, you declined to introduce an idea that she had in legislative form, saying that a 45-cent gas tax was just not going to fly. Let me ask, how do you feel about bonds?
I think that is a strong financial tool to use. And, when the legislature didn't come to the table, the Republican-led legislature, with a plan for raising the revenue, we have never disagreed that we need $2.5 billion in additional revenue to really address our problem. She needed to look at the other tools at her disposal, and bonding, especially in this current economic environment, is a really strong tool to use. And, obviously it was approved this morning with a 6-0 vote to move forward on it. So I'm really glad that she's at least tackling part of the problem, but it still falls on us in the legislature to get together and come up with a long-term funding solution.
Speaker Lee Chatfield told us he doesn't feel particularly great about $3.5 million worth of bonds. Given that the state already has bonding obligations left over going back to the Granholm administration, just how much capacity do you think the state has?
Well, actually, if you dig into the details, we have a lot of capacity, and we are actually retiring old debt. So as that retires and we ramp up this new bonding, there's actually a very little effect on the overall budget. So it's actually a really perfect time to do bonding.
The big question, of course, is the long-term plan, how to dedicate money to road maintenance. What sounds feasible to you given what happened last year? Is the legislature ready for another go-round on gas taxes?
You know, we have to keep talking about this. My caucus has already put forth some other ideas to talk about how to generate some new revenue. I know the speaker has floated the idea of looking at taking sales tax off of the gas pump so that more money is going to roads. Obviously, that's an idea we can talk about, but it's so incredibly important that the lost revenue from that switch would be backfilled appropriately to make sure that our schools and our local communities are not hurt because of that change. So I think there's some additional ideas on the table, but we have to keep talking and make sure that we are looking at a sustainable long-term plan and not just fixing part of the problem.
There's a strong current of awareness that seems to permeate what a lot of lawmakers are saying this year. How is this going to play out against the context of what's happening with national elections and the political mood of the country? With that in mind, Governor Whitmer mentioned a long list of priorities last night. Which of those issues sound most realistic to you for 2020?
Well, I think top of the list is what she's doing for the roads. I mean, again, just the day after this day of the state where she shared the bonding plan, it's already approved and the wheels are in motion, so to speak, pardon the pun. We are going into another construction year, and we have to address the high-priority roads in the state. So I think right away, that's obviously very realistic because it's already happening. And then after that, I think when we talk about education and we talk about training, I think that's where we can find some common ground because we all want everyone's kids to have opportunity to succeed. And we need that through more support for literacy, any early childhood development. It's just so important that we set kids off on the right foot, regardless where they live in this state. And I think we can find a lot of common ground in that. And then on the back end of someone's career, if, you know, they need to upgrade their skills and get reconnected to better jobs, the Michigan Reconnect program, too, is also an area where we can work together.
House Democratic Leader Chris Gregg of District 37 in Farmington, Farmington Hills. Thanks for talking to us.
Well, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
In just a minute, we're going to hear from State House Speaker Lee Chatfield and get his reaction to Governor Whitmer's proposals. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. So just how did Governor Whitmer's address go over with Republican leadership? Whitmer had some sharp words in her speech for the road funding dispute with Republicans that drove state government to the brink of a shutdown just months ago. Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield joins us now to talk about next session and last night's speech. Speaker Chatfield, welcome back to Stateside.
April, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
I don't know that the governor exactly handed you an olive branch last night. Did you hear anything that you can work with?
You know, there were several things that I think the governor mentioned last night that we can work with. First was her focus on criminal justice reform. The Michigan House has led over the past several years on several reforms that have moved our state forward that I'm very proud of, and it's a nonpartisan issue that we can work together to ensure that we're not over-criminalizing the citizens in our state, but also ensuring, April, that those that are leaving the system and re-entering our society have the tools they need to be successful. Secondly, she focused on mental health. I've been a strong proponent of that since day one of this term, saying we need to ensure that people across our state in every corner have more access to mental health services to ensure that they're getting the help that they need. Also, her call for civility to ensure that we in Michigan don't become a part of the political dysfunction that has plagued Washington, D.C., and because I believe the people are frustrated by that. So, April, there were several things I think we can work with, but obviously there were several disagreements that I'm going to have with the governor as well.
Governor Whitmer suggested that she is ready to raise $3.5 million in bonds to contribute toward the thorny issue of funding for road repairs. How is Michigan's bonding capacity looking right now? Can the state do that?
Let me take a step back before I answer that question. The governor now has proposed two different proposals to fix our roads. Her first proposal was a 45-cent gas tax on every single driver in our state. And the fact is, no one in the state supported it. She couldn't even get someone from her own party to introduce the bill. We tried to meet her in the middle and say, before we ever talk about raising taxes, Governor, let's first ensure that every penny that's paid in taxes at the pump is the penny that goes towards roads. So her 45-cent plan died, and now her second plan is to take out a loan, $3.5 billion loan. But the fact is this, April, we are already paying off loans from two other administrations that go back to Engler and Granholm. So while we do, yes, have the capability to bond, and we do have the capability to take out a loan, it can be done responsibly. But that is a financing tool. It is not a long-term funding proposal. So the governor wants to take out a loan, then come back and raise more taxes. And I've said from day one, we are not going to have a conversation about new taxes. We shouldn't be having a conversation about taking on a loan and passing it on to our children until we direct all tax dollars at the pump towards roads.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that the state's going to have to divert money away from the parts of the budget that the gas taxes are now diverted into? Or are you suggesting that we just need new revenue streams for roads and those other things?
So Michigan taxpayers, every time they fill up at the pump, they pay three taxes at the pump. One of those is the sales tax. The sales tax dollars do not go towards the road. So that is roughly $900 million annually that is siphoned off. People pay at the pump and it does not go towards roads. I would encourage you and others to look at the House budget that we passed last year in 2019. What we did is we directed all the dollars at the pump to go towards roads, and we did so not without cut. I could say we didn't cut education, but that doesn't do it justice. We actually gave education an increase. So we can do this responsibly, April. We can ensure that our roads get fixed, but the first thing shouldn't always be going right back to the pockets of our taxpayers.
So are you saying that gas tax monies that now go toward the school aid fund and revenue sharing, just that those need to be reconsidered and diverted back into roads?
No. See, the sales tax dollars will always go towards the schools and local units of government. But we can determine what we charge sales tax on. Our proposal was eliminate the sales tax at the pump, replace it with a revenue neutral, potentially a gas tax or an excise tax. So you're paying the same amount at the pump, but now all of those dollars go towards roads. And we can do that. So we can't constitutionally change the sales tax except it goes to the vote of the people. The legislature doesn't have the authority to do that. But this is a way to send all those dollars at the pump towards the roads. We did it in a way, though, April, that didn't cut revenue sharing and didn't cut education, because we looked at our budget responsibly and we prioritized, because that's what Michigan families are forced to do across the state every single day. And I think our state government needs to do it as well.
We sometimes hear that a true compromise doesn't make anyone truly happy. Are there aspects of road funding that you're willing to be upset about at this point?
Well, I would tell you bonding could be one of those aspects, right? It is a short-term financing tool. But she has admitted that this is not a long-term solution. But let me also share with you a little other frustration from many of us on the Republican side of the aisle from what we heard from the governor last night. In last year's budget, we gave an additional $400 million in one-time spending for roads. It fixed bridges, it fixed roads, and it was a record amount of funding that the state has ever seen for roads in last year's budget. The governor vetoed that $400 million, April, because she said it wasn't a long-term proposal. She said, I will not sign anything unless it's a long-term solution.
She reiterated that last night, actually. Yeah.
Then why is her next step a short-term bonding plan?
Are you saying that you might get on board for a bond plan if you could get some real movement on how the gas taxes are used?
Well, I would tell you this. Politics, it works that way many times. There's give and take. However, the governor does understand she has the unilateral authority to make some of these bonding decisions without approval of the legislature. It is then incumbent on the legislature to simply make the payments. We're already paying off bonds from two administrations. We can, if done right, have this conversation and do it responsibly, but this is not a long-term funding solution. So I found it hypocritical. I certainly found it to be revisionist history from this governor with how everything broke down last year, because Republicans have been willing 2019 to roll up our sleeves, get to work with this governor and find an actual compromise. But she was 45 cents or bust. So I'm hoping she has a change of heart in 2020.
The last third of the governor's address touched on a lot of issues, including wages for working people, expanding preschool, maternal health, especially for Black women who maybe experience discrepancies in the health system. Arguably, it's an agenda aimed at what happens to women. When we asked the governor about it, she said that women's issues are families' issues. We have just about a minute left. How do you predict that agenda might be received in the legislature?
Well, I told her this morning when I met with her that I look forward to seeing her proposals for doing what she laid out last night. I haven't seen individual bills. Part of what she said about the Affordable Care Act does depend on what happens with the federal government. So a lot of it is still hypothetical at this point, but we're going to do all we can to ensure that people in our state have access to good health care. That's what every single person wants. And I'm going to work with the governor to ensure that we can do that. And I told her I look forward to seeing the details, and we're going to get our teams together, put our heads together, and see what proposal she has. And we're always going to work with her on anything and everything that we can agree on. And when we do that, April, we found we've had success. You know, we have divided government in Lansing, but we can't be like Washington. And I'm going to work with her every step of the way because I care more about seeing the state succeed than seeing her fail.
Lee Chatfield, Republican from Levering, represents House District 107, and he is also the Speaker of the Michigan House of Representatives. Speaker Chatfield, thanks for your time.
April, thanks a lot. Always a pleasure.
Today, January 30th, is observed in some states and cities as Fred Korematsu Day. In 1943, Fred was a young welder working in his hometown of Oakland, California, when Japanese Americans were ordered to walk away from their lives for an indefinite period of internment. Korematsu was one of a trio of Americans who challenged their detention all the way to the United States Supreme Court. They lost. But after the war and his release, Fred got married, moved to Detroit for a few years, and went on with his life. His conviction was vacated in 1983 with established evidence that internment was grounded not in security concerns, but in deep-seated racism. Don Tamaki is one of the attorneys who worked on Fred Korematsu's exoneration. He's speaking at a University of Michigan law school event tonight in Ann Arbor. Don Tamaki, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
What was the justification the Roosevelt administration was using in court to defend internments?
The government claimed that Japanese Americans were engaging in spying for Tokyo, and those claims took two forms. One, they were engaging in shore-to-ship signaling, and secondly, they were so different as an ethnic population. They lived in a separate Japanese American community. They spoke a different language, a different religion, and therefore so different that they couldn't possibly be American, quote-unquote. And on that basis, this wholesale rounding up of Japanese Americans, two-thirds of whom were born in this country, occurred. We now know, some 37 years later, after the imprisonment took place, that none of it was true, and the government knew it at the time.
The author of this policy, General John DeWitt, had acknowledged privately there had been no acts of sabotage, but in part, we know now, thanks to the work that you and others did on the exoneration case, that he believed that the lack of the attacks was evidence that there was a larger plot in the works. He was sitting, waiting for something big to happen and took a lack of sabotage activity by Japanese Americans as proof that something definitely would happen.
So the way it went down was, of course, on December 7, 1941, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. And by February 19th of 1942, the president passed an executive order giving power to a general on the West Coast to begin issuing orders governing a civilian population, that is, Japanese Americans. And at first, he actually, General John L. DeWitt, was actually opposed to any rounding up, thought it was unnecessary. But at the time, the West Coast was rife with racial prejudice. It was a time when alternative facts and conspiracy theories really ruled the day. And General DeWitt engaged a colonel by the name of Carl Bendetson, a Stanford-educated lawyer who really should have known something about the Constitution, who basically began targeting this population. And even though there were not a single person arrested, let alone tried and convicted of sabotage, spun out the conspiracy theory that the very fact that no sabotage and no spying had ever occurred was a disturbing indication that, in fact, it would occur. So that's the kind of circular logic that was going on. The very fact that you've never committed a crime, you've never been accused of committing a crime, was proof positive that you would engage in criminal behavior.
What parallels do you see between the Korematsu case and the Muslim travel ban and other modern-day policies that have targeted people of color for a variety of perceived security risks?
The disturbing commonality in this case is the failure of the judiciary, the courts, to be a check and balance on the executive branch, that is, the military and the president. And any good high school civic student knows that we have three branches of government, the legislative, the judiciary, and the executive. And each is supposed to be a check and balance on the other. The framers designed it this way in order to thwart, I'd say, the rise of kings and tyrants. And the rounding up occurred. Three individuals you mentioned, Fred Korematsu, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Min Yusui, said that they're American citizens, they'd done nothing wrong, the government had no right to arrest not only them, but an entire racial population, men, women, and children, and lock them up such that they lost their property, they lost their freedom, some even lost their lives. These cases came up fundamentally due process challenges. And ultimately, regrettably, in 1943 and 1944, the court took the position that when the government invokes national security, the safety of the nation, the court is not going to second-guess the military and the president. And what happened, as we know, was a civil liberties disaster. None of it was true. The government knew it at the time. There was an intentional cover-up within the Justice Department that went all the way to the Attorney General of the United States as well as the Solicitor General of the United States. That's a problem. In other words, when the courts stand down, they don't ask any questions. The temptation of decision makers to make politically motivated decisions to, for example, appeal to their base or to fulfill a campaign promise, that temptation becomes overwhelming. Why? Because nobody is asking any questions. People are looking the other way. And Japanese Americans, you don't have to remind them of the dangers of that in terms of what happened. Now, when these cases went up on the travel ban to the U.S. Supreme Court, the government made a similar defense. They said that banning countries, Muslim majority, six of them ultimately, was for the safety of the nation. When these cases came up and they were tested in the lower courts, in the Maryland Federal District Court, Judge Theodore Chuan said, what is the basis for shutting down travel, separating American families, for instance, Iranian Americans who are born here but are unable to see their grandparents, for instance, or their parents? What's the basis for that? And the government replied, well, we've done a Homeland Security report global, and we've concluded that this makes the country safer. And the judge asked, may I see the report? And the government said, no, it's confidential. And ultimately, when these cases went up to the U.S. Supreme Court and was decided on June 26, 2018, nobody asked any questions. And the court basically said, you know, that Korematsu case, it was wrong the day it was decided. But by the way, this has nothing to do with Korematsu.
I think that's what Chief Justice John Roberts said.
That's right. Yeah. And if the government tells us this makes the country safer, then we believe the government. And the problem is this. The parallels between Korematsu and the travel ban case are disturbing. You know, both arose out of war. Both involved the government invoking national security in order to shield its decisions from any judicial scrutiny. Both involved a targeted minority. In World War II, it was Japanese Americans. Today, it's Muslims. Both involve hidden government reports that the government refused to disclose to the courts or to the public. And finally, both ended in the courts standing down, abdicating their constitutional role to ask probing questions. And the problem with that is that's how you begin to lose a democracy.
When these three cases first came before the United States Supreme Court, was there dissent from the bench? Were there voices saying, this is too much power for the executive, we can't let this happen?
Yes, and they did so without knowing what the evidence was. For example, we now know that J. Edgar Hoover had issued an authoritative report saying, we've investigated every single claim of spying. None of it is true. The Navy said there was no reason to round these people up in the first place. They should be treated no differently than the Italian-American or German-American population. The Federal Communications Commission had said, we monitor the airwaves, and General DeWitt's men are picking up signals emanating from Tokyo and calling them shore-to-ship transmissions. They're false. And Justice Department lawyers said to the Attorney General and the Solicitor General, it is highly unfair to this racial minority that these lies be put forth before the Supreme Court. This is the only opportunity for the Justice Department to correct this. And ultimately, they were rebuffed. The evidence was suppressed. It was even fabricated in order to manipulate the outcome of these landmark cases. Even without that information, Justice Owen Roberts of the then the U.S. Supreme Court had said, you know, the government has put forth no evidence for the rounding up these people. Instead, we now have a principle before us that lies around like a loaded weapon, ready for the hand of any authority who can put forth a plausible claim of an urgent need. This is Scalia's quote. If the government asserts an urgent need, it can do anything it wants. And he said the principle lies around like a loaded weapon. What does that mean? That without evidence, without trial, an entire population can lose their freedom on merely the naked assertion, unsupported by evidence or by trial, that this group did anything wrong. That is so contrary to American principles and the checks and balances system of our democracy. And that's the danger.
Don Tamaki is a partner at Minami Tamaki, LLC. He is going to be part of the discussion tonight at the University of Michigan Law School in Hutchins Hall for Fred Korematsu Day. Don, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Coming up, an investigative exclusive from Michigan Radio's newsroom about the nefarious actions of a man from a celibate Christian sect in Michigan. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm April Baer. Just a warning, the next story that we have for you will not be appropriate for all listeners. It includes reporting on child sex abuse. A longtime member of a celibate Christian service organization returns to Michigan after decades of mission work overseas. And soon, two families report him for sexually abusing their children. He's been reported before, but he still gets off the hook. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith has this story of how law enforcement and a religious group let a suspected child predator go.
4 years ago, Rob Barrett gets a phone call from a new friend of his.
Hey, I want to do some snow sculpture. Could the girls do some snow sculpture with me?
Rob's new friend is Jamie Treadwell. He's a tall, slim, balding white guy. In 2016, he made friends with Rob and his wife, Crystal Barrett. Back then, Treadwell is a 58-year-old artist, life coach, world traveler, a man of faith.
He comes over, and next thing you know, there's this Moses in our front yard.
I've got pictures that they've made. The whole neighborhood was totally impressed.
It's not just a snowman, it's a sculpture. Moses holding his hand up in the air, pointing to the heavens, and all this, and it is astounding.
I had neighbors texting me, were like, holy cow, how
did you know there's a Moses
in
the yard?
What in the world is, you know?
Jamie Treadwell is like a big kid. That's how the Barrett's daughters would later describe him to police. So nice, so fun. When it warms up in the spring, Treadwell asks to wash his car at their house. Starts a big water fight with the girls.
They were really, really, really liked him. I mean, like, really liked him.
A few months into their friendship, Treadwell is at the Barrett's house at least a couple times a week. Sometimes he just pops by, unannounced. When it is planned, Treadwell shows up super early. Rob wouldn't be home from work yet, and Crystal notices Treadwell always disappears with her girls into areas of the house or backyard she cannot see.
Then I would go and find them, and they were almost always playing some kind of a game that involved a lot of physical contact, which is not really what we do in our house. Like, we don't...
And again, that's part of the attraction, because
yeah,
they were
so
having
different.
so much fun playing tickle games with him in ways that we didn't do.
When the Barretts meet him, Jamie Treadwell has just moved back to Michigan from Europe, where he ran a program for at-risk youth. He's new in town, so he asked to join Rob Barrett and his family at their church in Grand Rapids.
I really felt honored that he would want to spend time with us. This amazing guy with all of this stuff going on has taken an interest in us.
Treadwell is part of a Christian brotherhood called the Servants of the Word. About 60 celibate men make up the Servants of the Word, living single for the Lord, as they put it. They live communally, share money and possessions. Home base is near Chelsea, Michigan, but the group has houses all over the world, including Grand Rapids. Treadwell transfers to that house in 2015. We will get to this group and what they knew about Jamie Treadwell in a bit. But first, back to the Barretts. One night, this is in May of 2016, Rob and Crystal and their daughters and Treadwell are sitting around the kitchen table. Treadwell turns to Crystal and says,
"Hey, Crystal, do you remember when we talked about how fun it would be for me to stay the night sometime?" In my head, I thought, no, we've never talked about how fun it would be for you to stay the night. I don't arrange sleepovers with adult men.
It is not unusual for the Barretts to have overnight guests. They lived overseas, so they have friends all over the world and family across the country who come stay in their guest room. But Treadwell only lives a mile and a half away.
And then my girls start saying, "Oh, that would be really fun. We can play these board games. We can do this. We can do that." And then he said, "And, you know, it's my birthday on Saturday, and it would just be so much nicer to spend the time with you all than by myself. The brothers are out of town."
Crystal goes from feeling frustrated and confused to planning to make Treadwell homemade cinnamon rolls for his birthday. She cannot put her finger on what exactly she's anxious about. The night Treadwell stays over, Crystal sits up in bed, tells Rob, "Please, go sleep in the girls' room."
I was literally laying awake at night for hours on end thinking, this really seems like this guy is setting us up, like, to molest my kids. Like, this is what this feels like. And then the next thing in my head would be, but what if you're wrong? What if this isn't that? And your kids love him, and he loves them, and he loves being part of your family. And what if you're wrong? There's part of me now that's just like, oh, good grief. What if there was even a 20% chance this is what this was about? Like, these are your girls. But I felt like if I wasn't 100% sure, I couldn't say anything to anybody.
Rob sleeps in the girls' room that night. Nothing bad happens. Still, Crystal is on high alert. Then one Sunday in September 2016, something does happen that confirms Crystal's worst fears about Jamie Treadwell. He pops by after church, unannounced. Crystal is in the kitchen making lunch. Rob, the girls, and Treadwell are in the living room.
Rob comes into the kitchen to start setting the table because it's getting close to lunch being ready. And I looked up at him and I said, "Rob, I'll take care of all this. I'll make the lunch and I'll set the table. Please don't leave him in the room alone with the girls."
Not even for a minute, she tells Rob, "Watch him." So Rob returns to the living room. His younger daughter is perched on Treadwell's lap. She's playing a game on an iPad. Treadwell is watching her game too, but Rob notices Treadwell's rubbing his daughter's legs.
For some reason, that just struck me as going, that's a little weird.
In full view, Treadwell is rubbing this 8-year-old's upper thighs.
As he's doing that, then her legs spread apart for whatever reason, I don't know. And then his hand just reached over into her crotch and just rubbed twice right between her legs and then casually moved away. And it was just, he's not looking, he's just doing whatever with her. And that was when my brain exploded.
The Barretts make several calls about Jamie Treadwell. To the police, yes. Rob's younger daughter doesn't remember Treadwell touching her inappropriately. His older daughter tells investigators Treadwell touched her breasts during tickle games. She hadn't mentioned it before because she thought it was an accident. The Barretts also contacted the leaders of the Servants of the Word, that celibate religious brotherhood Treadwell is a part of. Rob Barrett talks to the group's leaders on the phone several times. They even drive across the state to meet with the Barretts. Rob says they tell him,
"You know, Jamie's been told by his lawyer, don't talk to anybody about anything." They spend time with him and they say he just sits there silent. He will not say a word.
They have a meeting, he says nothing. And they just talk and he says nothing.
Leaders of the group wouldn't talk to Michigan Radio. But in a series of emails and documents, one thing is clear. Parents have raised concerns about Jamie Treadwell before. Concerns that did reach someone at the Servants of the Word at least 10 years ago, long before he moved back to Michigan from Europe. East Grand Rapids police take the Barretts' complaint. They investigate. They want Treadwell charged with second-degree criminal sexual conduct. This is the part where you might think, Jamie Treadwell is going to get arrested. But that's not what happens.
A lot of these cases do come down to some sort of corroborating evidence.
This is the Kent County prosecutor, Chris Becker. I interviewed him in September, 3 years after the Barrett's case was referred to him for prosecution in 2016. Becker says there's just not enough evidence to prove the Barrett's case beyond a reasonable doubt.
You had the dad making essentially a disclosure saying he saw something, but his two daughters didn't back him up.
So just hours after the warrant request lands on his desk, Becker decides not to charge Treadwell.
Under sexual assault law, you know, prior instances of other sexual assaults or molestations are admissible. So those could play a role in swinging the balance, you know, towards charging if we have evidence of that.
If only Becker had more evidence, if only more victims had come forward, things might have worked out differently. I want you to remember this. We're going to come back to it. First, I want you to meet another family who says Treadwell also crossed the line with their daughter. Because that same summer of 2016, when Jamie Treadwell is hanging out with the Barretts, he's also making friends with another family in the Lansing area.
And he's like flipping Santa Claus. I mean, so fun. She thinks he's like the funnest guy ever.
This family is part of a religious group with strong ties to the celibate brotherhood that Treadwell is in. This family asked that we not use their names to protect their daughter's identity. Back in 2016, their daughter is 5. This dad hires Treadwell as a business coach, but they're social, too. And the way Treadwell builds that friendship will sound familiar. He invites himself over, there are tickle games and car washes, and he asks this family if he can stay overnight one weekend. He's got an art show in town. He shows up early, before dad's home from work. Mom is apologetic. She hasn't had time to get the sheets on his bed in the basement.
And then he looks at my daughter, puts his hands on his knees, and he says, "Wanna help me make the bed? And don't worry about me, you go keep working on dinner." And like a fool, I do what I was told. I go upstairs back to the kitchen and start stirring a pot that's on the stove.
Upstairs, this mom has second thoughts about leaving her daughter in the basement with Jamie Treadwell. She feels a pit in her stomach when she gets back downstairs and sees him laying on the air mattress, spooning her daughter, rubbing her lower belly. This mom interrupts the spooning, crouches down to her daughter's level and says,
"This basement door is Mr. Treadwell's bedroom door. He needs his privacy. When he is here, you are not to come down to the basement. You need to be upstairs the rest of the time."
Treadwell is silent. But when her husband comes home, mom doesn't get a chance to mention the spooning incident. It's hectic. She's busy cooking dinner, and then they all eat together. The whole family piles in the car and goes to Treadwell's art show. The next morning, dad's brushing his teeth when he hears Treadwell talking to someone in the kitchen.
"You know, it's my daughter. I assume it's her that he's talking to."
Dad hears the basement door open, so he peeks his head out of the bathroom.
"I'm like, okay, I heard him. I thought I heard her. And I definitely heard the door open and close to the basement and then go downstairs."
He opens the basement door. It's pitch black.
"I turn on the main light and I walk down the stairs and I start calling out my daughter's name.
No answer. So dad does a lap around the main area of the basement. Treadwell's room is off to the side. It's dark in there too.
I'm uncomfortable actually going into that room and turning on the light. Maybe he doesn't want to say anything because he's uncomfortable because he's in the middle of changing and I'm down there. Who knows, right?"
He calls his daughter's name a few more times. Still, nothing. So he goes back upstairs.
And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, he's definitely down there. Why didn't he say something? I'm almost positive she's down there as well. The fact that she didn't say something is very weird. So I go back downstairs. I do one more lap. And as I'm passing by his room, I reach in and I turn on the light. And I see him standing there looking gray, you know, hands at his sides, looking uncomfortable, a little sweaty. And she's in the bed with the sheets kind of half over her. And I don't know what to say.
Dad looks at his daughter and says, "It's time to go." Treadwell says nothing. This family also reports Jamie Treadwell to police. Their 5-year-old later tells investigators that she and Treadwell heard her dad calling, but they were playing hide and seek from her dad, that under the blankets, they told each other secrets. The police officer warns these parents, never let your children around Treadwell again. Here's the thing that drives me nuts about this case. The Kent County prosecutor, he didn't charge Treadwell in the East Grand Rapids case because there wasn't any corroborating evidence. Our reporting shows that's just not true. Here's what happens in the fall of 2016. This Lansing area family files a police report about Jamie Treadwell just 2 weeks after the Barretts filed their police report in East Grand Rapids. Officers from both police departments, they talk to each other. Police in both jurisdictions merge these two police reports to bolster the case against Jamie Treadwell. So when the Barretts report goes to the Kent County prosecutor, he has the Lansing area family's complaint too. I asked the prosecutor, Chris Becker, about this.
I don't recall a tangential report out of Lansing.
Becker says he never saw the other police report from the Lansing family back in 2016. Not until I pointed it out to him 3 years later.
When we reviewed it, there were some things about, you know, they had talked about he may have done it other places, but I don't recall seeing anything or looking at any sort of reports out of any other jurisdictions.
Now that he has seen it, Becker says he can always take another look. Quote, "Nothing is ever closed unless the statute of limitations has run on a case," he says in an email. That limit hasn't passed yet. Back in 2016, Treadwell refuses to talk to police. We wanted to get his side of the story. So this fall, I tracked him down to a church in Ann Arbor, follow him to a gas station in Dexter, tell him I need to talk to him about the Barretts.
This is kind of a bizarre conversation.
I don't think Treadwell is going to talk to me, so the audio quality on this windy day isn't great. Treadwell tells me he's heard that the Barretts have been stirring up rumors about him.
There's a terrible misunderstanding. I wish they would want to work with that, but as far as I can tell, they haven't contacted me.
Treadwell denies inappropriately touching the Barrett children. I ask him why he would repeatedly bring the Lansing family's 5-year-old into the basement. The mom says she made it clear she did not want her child down there.
They might have said that, but I didn't pick that up. So that's why I'm saying, okay, I just didn't see that.
And then he takes an unexpected turn. Treadwell places blame on this 5-year-old girl. Blames the Barretts for abusing his character.
Like, where's there any kind of human decency in this, you know, for someone in my situation? Because, I mean, you know that. You're a reporter. It absolutely destroys my life. It already has. I'm trying to find a way that I can be responsible to who I am and work in very different areas, but also learn from this.
Maybe God brought you into my life, he tells me. After our conversation, Jamie Treadwell asks to leave the Servants of the Word. The leaders of the Brotherhood now say they know of at least 4 complaints that went to authorities. The Brotherhood won't say how long it's known about these claims. They won't say what those allegations are, who made them or when, not even what continent they took place on. And now, Treadwell doesn't have to answer to the leadership of the Servants of the Word. He's accountable to no one but himself. The families in this story wonder if other children are at risk. Because now, more than ever, Treadwell is a free man. I'm Lindsay Smith, Michigan Radio News.
If you'd like to read Lindsay's full story right now, you'll find it on our website, michiganradio.org. That's it for today's show. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.